Hey there! Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower-than-low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hi, I'm Brent Flyberg.
And I'm Vince Mancini.
And this is Pod Yourself the Wire. And today we're talking about Season 1, Episode 11 of The Wire, The Hunt, which premiered on HBO August 18th, 2002. You might notice I am not Matt Lieb. Matt Lieb is taking care of his child or something.
He's on sabbatical.
Mr. Big Sloppa. They call him Big Sloppa now. And he's not here, but I'm here. So the first thing I'm going to do is Vince's favorite thing that Matt does and implore our listeners to give us 5 stars and review on Apple Podcasts and sign up for the Patreon, because now Matt has to save up enough money to send his child to presumably trade school. If they're smart, trade school.
That's right, yeah.
Maybe even college. I don't know.
Yeah.
Sign up.
You know, Joe Brandon's only doing that loan forgiveness once, so you better get that kid some carpentry skills, you know?
Yeah, you know, I regret not being a plumber. That actually seems kind of nice. Instead, I'm here talking about The Wire with you guys. And I actually, you know what? I take it back. I'd rather be doing this than plumbing.
That's right. This is not a podcast about plumbing. This is a podcast about The Wire, a show about how men would literally rather puke in a trash can than go to therapy. And today's guest, you know him, you love him. He's new to Pod Yourself the Wire. It's writer and humorist Ben Flores from the Please Save Me podcast.
Hey, what's up? Thank you for having me.
Anytime.
I had something I want to say, but I hadn't been introduced yet, but I had a thing about the carpentry, you know?
Which was
got to because who else is going to build back better?
That's right. Yeah,
exactly.
Are you or have you ever been a carpenter?
Ooh, I took a shop class in high school. It was taught by a long-term substitute teacher for most of the semester because the shop teacher cut his finger off.
Nice.
That's how you know he's a legit shop teacher.
Yeah. And we spent a lot of the semester, like a lot of time doing the long tables in that classroom had the little holes in them for power cables or whatever to go through, you know, like computer cables to go through.
Oh,
whatever.
Smart, yeah.
And so we would kind of set up little golf courses to roll golf balls into those.
Oh, that sounds sick. Yeah,
that sounds
those
great.
Are the enduring memories of that class. So and I guess the answer is yes.
Yes. Yeah, and was this in Moscow, Idaho? Did I see that right?
Yeah. Usually people say Moscow, Idaho, but you went for the Moscow, Idaho. Yeah. Uh-huh.
Is that
shout out to the Palouse, Zips Burgers.
Zips Burgers is good. Yeah, they get seasoned fries.
Oh, so you've been there, Brent.
I have, yes. So I Moscow is the home of University of Idaho, and it's just across the state line from Pullman, which is where Washington State University is. And I went to a public high school in Washington, so a lot of my friends were Cougs, went to the Washington State University.
Right up until that last bit, still thought you were doing the kind of the whole Wikipedia thing, because those all were sort of super top level facts, you know, that would be in the first paragraph of the
Moscow Wikipedia. Yeah.
So how close was Moscow life to the movie Napoleon Dynamite, the most famous movie ever shot in Idaho?
Yeah, Napoleon Dynamite has shades of that, you know. It's like it's not a whole different universe, you know. Like, you know, for some, like if you grew up in New York City or whatever, you know, Napoleon Dynamite might as well be a freaking foreign film, you know?
What are you going to do? Say I'm freaking walking here to a llama? I don't think so.
Exactly. Yeah. What do they talk about? You know, what do they eat? Yeah. There's no 99 cent slices.
Yeah. They don't have bodegas for their chopped, what do they call it? Chopped cheese. That's the one. Yeah.
Yeah.
The Aki way.
They get,
yeah.
They eat the tots.
Yes.
You know?
So you are not, just to clarify, you are not Benjamin Flores Jr., a.k.a. Lil Peanut, the American child actor and rapper?
I'm not, but one time, I used to teach third grade, and one time one of the third graders did ask if that was my son. And I say that that's my, I tell people that's my career plan, is to sort of insinuate, without lying, to insinuate in meetings I have with, you know, executives and stuff, that he is my son.
Yeah, you might be able to get him involved in whatever so project. Like,
exactly. Yeah, you got to coast on
his
followers.
You know what, I think it'd be fun. You know, what if you could get Benjamin Flores Sr., that's what I like to call myself, and Benjamin Flores Jr. in it, you know?
So, some brief interview questions before we get into this. Do you enjoy The Wire?
Love it. Love it. I've seen the whole thing through more than once.
Really? So do you have did you watch it at the time, or did you have to catch up later?
Let me think. You know, I would have been on probably my fourth or fifth 21st birthday around the time this show came out. No, I'm just kidding. Dating myself here. let me think actually, how old was I when this episode came out? I was about 15. So we didn't get HBO. So I did watch it though as it was coming out, like on DVD at the end of the, you know, the way most people probably saw it at mm-hmm. the time, like at the end of the season.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So you
and
as
I do remember it was a show where I would like stop. I watched it with my parents, you know, and as a 15-year-old, like so much of it was just like keeping track of all the plot lines and stuff. There would definitely be like, okay, let's pause. Like, what the fuck's happening?
Yeah.
Impressed that you as a 15-year-old were able to keep up with this. I didn't watch it until I was probably like 23. There's zero chance I could have kept up with this at 16.
Yeah, I mean, even now, watching it now, I was actually curious, you know, just because we're rewatching this sequentially and we've seen the previous episodes, like I have a pretty good grasp on what's happening. Did you just jump into this one and were you able to figure out what the hell was going on?
Well, this is a big, I mean, this is like major, this is like kind of like a major climactic moment of season one. So probably it was easier to jump right. I did kind of jump right in. Like I refreshed myself on the previous episode. I just glanced at the Wikipedia. Mm-hmm. You know? But it's probably easier to jump into some of it than it would be kind of like a random mid-season episode. Cause it's like, well, it's the aftermath of like this big thing.
Yeah.
And the whole episode is pretty focused.
Right. These are like the big plot lines, not like something small that you would have forgotten.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And I feel like there's less, you know, I feel like there are fewer plot lines in this episode than there could be because the A story is so emotional that it like they give it a lot of screen time, you know,
mm-hmm.
like all the characters converge sort of into like single locations. So you're not kind of like intercutting just like a whole shitload of like, wait, who is this person?
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
On that note, Brent, you want to break us off a little bit of that synopsis?
Yeah, the synopsis for today's episode is the Baltimore PD jumps into high gear to try to figure out who shot Kima, and in the process, they look like they're competent, but still bastards. The Barksdale crew does their best to clean up their mess, and Bubbles tries to stay clean.
What a great synopsis. Did you write that or did Matt write that?
No, I wrote that one.
Oh, look at that. But before we discuss today's episode, you know, we need cultural context, obviously. And
well, hold on. Before we do that, we need to hear the theme.
Oh, yeah, that's right. We do need to hear the theme.
Pod. Down in the hole. 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 Podcast.
All right. And sorry, what were you saying there, Vince?
Oh, something about context. You know, we got to go all the way back to August 18th, 2002 for this episode to try and figure out what was going on at the time. And to do that, we use a little something we like to call the back in the day machine.
It's a bad time for newspapers. The news hole is shrinking as advertising dollars continue to decline.
There ain't no back in the day.
Machine tells the tale, son.
That's right. Like I said, we're going all the way back to 2002. August 18th, the dog days of summer. Some of the headlines that were happening. Do you guys remember old Lizzie Grubman? Does that name ring a bell?
She's like a PR person?
Yeah, a little bit. Elizabeth S. Grubman, the Manhattan publicist who was charged with backing her SUV into a crowd outside a nightclub in the Hamptons, plans to plead guilty and settle the case against her, according to lawyers familiar with the case. The lawyers said they expected the announcement that the plea had been accepted. That was when Ms. Grubman, 31, is expected to appear in Suffolk County Court. The plea deal is believed to involve community service and at least 60 days in a minimum security jail in Suffolk County. And the crime that she was charged with, about 12:40 a.m. on July 7th, 2001, witnesses and police said Ms. Grubman got into a shouting match with two bouncers at a popular Southampton nightclub, the Conscience Point Inn. Ms. Grubman got into her 2001 Mercedes-Benz SUV and backed into a crowd near the entrance, injuring 16 people before leaving the scene in another car.
Holy shit. Well, I'm not familiar with the East Coast. Is Southampton... The thought of a Southampton nightclub seems strange to me. What is Southampton? Do you guys know?
I assume that's in the Hamptons.
It's in the Hamptons. So, no, I mean, no, because it's like, I mean, it's because it's a bunch of rich people. So they want to, they go out there to party.
Yeah.
Like,
got it. Okay.
Yeah. When they're, you know.
They're vague. They're in vacation. In
the, there's actually a saying, you know, when in the Hamptons.
back into nightclubs.
You just fill in the blank with whatever you want. You know, it's implied.
The case caused a media sensation because of Ms. Grubman's high profile. She is the daughter of entertainment lawyer Alan Grubman and has represented celebrity clients like Britney Spears. Witnesses have said Ms. Grubman yelled white trash at one of the club's bouncers before backing her vehicle into the crowd.
Okay, yeah, well, that was pretty cool. there's one upside is that this is racially motivated in a way that makes it worse, you know?
who amongst us? You know, that's what I was thinking when I first started hearing this story.
In sports news, Barry Bonds, he was still out there hitting dingers.
Hell yeah.
And on this day, he hit a broken bat home run, and everybody was pretty impressed about it.
Very nice.
Exactly. The bat shattered, the ball sailed, and Barry Bonds smiled. Bonds' latest home run wasn't as memorable as the one before, but it was the hot topic after the Florida Marlins beat the San Francisco Giants 7-3 on Saturday.
Now, did you write that? Now I want to know who wrote this. Did you write this? Or is this a synopsis pre-written?
This is Mark Long from the Associated Press.
Because it has a really like sort of middle grades tone to it, you know. It sounds like like, do you remember the Christopher Ryan novels? You know, like the kids books that are all about like sports.
The
you know?
Dog
like,
fell. Like, oh yeah. Baseball. The cat went meow.
Yeah. Kind of like, you know, like the little detail that Barry Bonds smiled felt very juvenile. Yeah. Of course he did, man. He just hit a home run with a broken bat.
A lot of hitting coaches talk about getting extension, but that's ridiculous. The head of the bat went almost as far as the ball. The more you think about it, the more amazing it is. The players in the field were equally impressed. I looked at Preston Wilson and said, "Oh my God," outfielder Kevin Millar said. "I've never seen anything like that. That's a bad man." So that's Barry Bonds for you.
This was, now I remember that because I played baseball in high school, and this was when they started using more, this is probably boring baseball backstory, but this is when people stopped using ash bats and started using maple bats, and maple bats were more likely to shatter. And I remember people talking about like someday, like one of these guys is going to he's going to hit a home run with a broken bat. And of course it was, you know, the strongest man to ever play baseball.
Are they still using maple?
I think so. I don't know. I'm not following bat technology as closely as I was at 17, but I think that that's kind of the standard now. Yeah.
My dad has a famous picture of Joe DiMaggio boning his bat. I don't know if you know about that, but like back in the day, they used to take like a, I don't know what kind of bone, like a rib bone, and they would just like rub it on the bat to like compress the wood to make it, harder and more dense.
Not like a Jobu. I don't know.
Yeah, no, he wasn't doing like a Santeria voodoo ceremony on it. Yeah, he was actually like using the bone as a tool, as a primitive tool.
Okay,
as the Italians are known for. other stories that were happening. This one, you know, I got to get back to the one story that was dominating all the headlines and summer 2002 was getting ready to invade Iraq. And this one comes from the New York Times. Officers say U.S. aided in Iraq war despite use of gas. A covert American program during the Reagan administration provided Iraq with critical battle planning assistance at a time when American intelligence agencies knew that Iraqi commanders would employ chemical weapons in waging the decisive battles of the Iran-Iraq war, according to senior military officers with direct knowledge of the program.
I'm not mad. I'm just disappointed.
That's right.
Hold on. Sorry. Can you? I don't understand. What are they saying? That the Reagan administration.
So basically,
helped?
The big part of our justification for invading Iraq in 2002 was that they gassed their citizens and they have mm-hmm. these weapons and these biological weapons. But back in the 80s, we were giving them a lot of help during the Iran-Iraq war, and
including
so we
the
gave
gas.
Them a lot of assistance knowing that they were probably gonna use some gas
of course
and we were
of
just
course,
hoping they'd yeah, use it so. On Iran. Those officers, most of whom agreed to speak on the condition that they not be identified. Iran's use of gas in that conflict is repeatedly cited by President Bush and this week by his national security advisor Condoleezza Rice as justification for regime change in Iraq. Anyway,
pretty cool.
A little in the weeds, you know. You can't expect.
So the Reagan
people...
administration also did the Iraq War. That's also their fault.
Yeah. We could.
Cool.
I mean, I don't know that they did it. You kind of
right.
got to give the older Bush credit for at least knowing that trying to take out Saddam was going to be a big pain in the ass and more trouble than it was worth. But
Right. I shouldn't give Reagan all the glory. Both of the Bushes get a little bit of shine on this too. They were doing their jobs yeah. as well. Pretty
well, you
sick.
get Bush's son in there, and he's like, "Why was my yeah. dad such a pussy? Let's go fuck this guy up." And that's what they did, and the world lived happily ever after.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I mean, I live in a safer world. I'm sure of it.
Mission accomplished.
That's yeah. right. Well, you know what we had to do. We had to go over to Iraq and show them who we are. And that is what today's episode of The Wire is about. The cops, they suffer a murder in the family, and they got to go out on those streets and show them who they are. Thoughts on this episode, Brent?
Yeah, my thoughts on this are, one, it's so much funnier than I would have expected an episode about cops like trying to catch someone who shot one of their own. My biggest thought is, and I'd love to hear what Ben has to think about whether or not The Wire is copaganda, because that's like a question that's come up a lot. I think that's a question that comes up a lot about The Wire. And watching this episode, I think it is... If you wanted to make an argument for the show being propaganda, this episode might be one of the strongest arguments for that. But I think if you watch this and think that it as a show is presenting the police or the drug war as like a good idea, then you're already blue line pilled. Like you're stupid because they look competent for the first time in the series. Maybe they're all like focused and working together and doing like good investigation, but it is 100% just like a tribalism thing where they're just like, nah, not one of ours. You can't do this to one of ours. So yeah, those are my general thoughts. Ben?
Yeah, I mean, I think a lot of the, well, first of all, overall, I think it's sort of like the goalposts kind of have moved in 20 years on what is copaganda, you know, mm-hmm. because I remember watching this. I mean, I probably watched it a year after it came out or whatever, but I remember watching The Wire and just being blown away that it was like the first, now I was 16, you know, but that it was the first show I'd seen where I was like, oh, they don't just like the criminals are treated like people, you know, like they're yeah. part of the show, you know, like yeah. that was revelatory, mm-hmm. you know? And so that kind of, there's that. And then I think to the extent that it's copaganda that like there's there are police within the institution and there's a version of policing that is effective and admirable, mm-hmm. and then it's been hampered by bad management but like by bad management and by bad policy, by the drug war. Yeah. But like it does crystallize in an episode like this where like there's a little bit of a crucible of crisis here where like the kind of the true colors, which are good of a lot of different people, shine in this moment of community and crisis, you know, like, and like, yeah, you've got like Herc and Carver, you know, like Robin Cash, but like, but that's also to an extent, like you look at how that functions as propaganda, compare that to even some of the stuff in like We Own This City more recently, it's kind of like, yeah, taking that cash is very pedestrian and sort of, we still like we can still kind of excuse it as like, oh, this is a couple of guys who ultimately are going to be good. We can already feel like giving in to their worst nature, you know?
I mean, so, yeah. Like to me, this is a the scene where Rawls explains to McNulty that it's not his fault that Kima got shot. You want to just play that clip so we can?
Yeah, I'll play that clip. Yeah, this is a great clip. Not, it's also a great like David Simon. Like, there's so much swearing for no real reason.
Listen to me, you fuck. You did a lot of shit here. You played a lot of fucking cards, and you made a lot of fucking people do a lot of fucking things they didn't want to do. This is true. We both know this is true. Dr. Ralston, please call cardiology. Dr. Ralston. You, McNulty, are a gaping asshole. We both know this. Fuck if everybody in CID doesn't know it. But fuck if I'm going to stand here and say you did a single fucking thing to get a police shot. You did not do this. You fucking hear me? This is not on you. No, it isn't, asshole. Believe it or not, everything isn't about you. And the motherfucker saying this, he hates your guts, McNulty. So you know if it was on you, I'd be the son of a bitch to say so. Shit went bad. She took two for the company. That's the only lesson here.
Yeah. So to me, like, this is the perfect microcosm of The Wire because, first of all, you have, you know, this very, this speech that is inherently schmaltzy, like, wrapped in the sheen of vulgarity, which is, like, David Simon's kind of whole thing. He's a romantic, but he also loves swear words. And it's not, like, a new thing to do that. And you could definitely read this as at least the first part. Like you could read it as this sort of schmaltzy statement of this is when the cops come together, you know, one of their own is down. And this guy who's a dick who you've come to hate in this season, he actually cares about one of his guys when the chips are down. Like he's going to have his officers back, and that's what makes him a good guy. So like that's one read on it. But like, to me, what makes this The Wire is like the very end of that when he gets to, what's the lesson here? You know, she took two for the company. What does he say? Shit went bad. She took two for the company. You know, we couldn't have done anything about it. Like he's saying that. And like the reason that The Wire is more than just the first part is like it's giving you that tag on the end, which is very much saying like it's meant to be read ironically, like after this guy fucked up this entire operation and pushed through what was clearly like a stupid idea to do this drug bust that like even Carver at the time was like, that sounds like a really dumb idea. Of course they're going to know that this guy is a snitch. Like they did this dumb idea, put their officer in danger and their CI in danger. And after that, the only lesson they took from it was, I don't know, man. We criminals are bad. Like that was, and yeah.
Yeah, he's basically like, I refuse to learn anything.
Exactly.
From
like this whole episode is just cops like refusing to learn lessons and refusing to change up how they're doing things no matter what happens.
Yeah, and it's great that it starts with Rawls like, yeah, if we want to go through it beat by beat, it starts with Rawls like for the first time kind of like it reminded me, I'm glad that Chrisman brought up The Office in the last episode because this reminded me of a specific episode of The Office too. You know the one where Michael and I think Jan have to sell to Tim Meadows Uh-huh. And it's a great episode because Tim Meadows is in it, but also because it's the first time where you understand like how Michael became the boss, because he's actually like really good at this like one-on-one sales thing. Mm-hmm. And so you have this moment, because the whole time you're just like, why is this asshole in charge?
Yeah.
And then you see him, he shows up to the crime scene and he immediately like takes control in a way that is clearly like needed. And you see that like, oh, he's got some like leadership skills or something. Like he clearly, there's some reason that he rose to this position, and you see that for a second and you're like, yeah. And if you're dumb, you're like, oh, cause he's a good guy. Like,
yeah. Right.
Yeah. So we move from the crime scene out, you know, everybody's off investigating the crime scene. And then we go back into the office. Herc just shows up. Herc has been gone for the last episode. Yeah. He was on a training. Like, I really am curious if there was a backstory where Dominic Lombardozzi had to go do something else, or he had another acting gig where he couldn't be on set for that episode at all. I don't know, but
he was auditioning for Entourage. Yeah. 10 years early.
He's back though. He's back in this episode,
and he announces that he's back by just showing up and going, "What the fuck happened?" Like, that's his first line.
Yeah.
And they also,
he's rubbing his eyes.
They also flip McNulty's catchphrase. What did I do? He's like, he goes from being innocent to being like, he's mad at himself. Like
being like a martyr.
He's genuinely introspective when he says it in this episode. Mm-hmm. That's how you know we're coming up to the finale. So then we're in in Kima's hospital room, all the cops are standing around trying to figure out what to do. And then we meet the commissioner for the first time, who is apparently above the deputy ops. Like, up until now, like, I kind of just assumed the deputy ops was like the police commissioner. But apparently there's a guy even higher than that who's sort of like a figurehead. And he comes in and immediately does a racism. he sees... what is that other guy from Homicide that's in that scene?
Burrell, the deputy ops.
Well, Burrell's there, but then there's a white homicide guy. Yeah. Who's like, I forget that guy's name.
Never learned that guy's name.
Yeah.
There are a couple of people here that feel like, kind of like ciphers to me or whatever. That's not the right word, but like the commissioner looks. Yeah. Composites. Like the commissioner looks. You know, I don't remember how long this guy lasts in the show, but like he looks kind of like a dollar store version of some other guys who are in the show. Like there's a little bit of Rawls in him. There's a little bit of like, who's the really old cop, you know, like the whole stick in the mud.
Yeah. Mahone or Polk.
Yeah. Mm. And then the other guy, the homicide detective, you're kind of like, there's not a lot of screen time given to just like random other cops in this show.
Yeah, there's like, one guy who's sort of like in between, because there's like a continuum from like good cops that are doing things like Freeman and McNulty to the ones who are clearly there to like pick up a paycheck, like Polk and Mahone, and are complete dumbasses. Santangelo also. And then there's this other white guy who's sort of in between. He's like, he's not quite as much of a fuck up as Polk, but he's like, he's there, he's trying to do his job. So anyway, the commissioner comes in and he sees that guy who's white and naturally assumes that this guy is the lieutenant, and starts talking to him, and then he realizes it's actually Daniels. And
Lance Kendricks is doing amazing eyeball acting in that scene.
This whole episode.
He's so good. Yeah, he's really good.
I mean, he has a whole face turn in this episode that is conveyed like almost 100% through looks.
Mm-hmm.
Because
he's like clearly so pissed, but it's also like, well, this is my boss's boss's boss. What am I going to do? It's great. He's phenomenal.
So focusing on just the cop side of this, you got your gumshoe detectives like Landsman and I forget who else is there. That white guy.
Landsman, Bunk. Is it Santangelo?
Yeah, they're doing their shoe leather. They're out like sort of following footsteps from the crime scene, trying to see where they lead.
And Lanzmann is so sweaty, so fast. I love that. He looks like Bruce, rounding up to the closer, just like dripping in sweat. He alternates between looking like Bruce and looking like Gil from The Simpsons, like just sort of flop sweat, undone tie. It's great. I love it.
I could see a little bit of Bruce Valanche in there, maybe. Maybe that's just because, so, random aside, but me and Matt went to a press screening like about 3 weeks ago, right before his baby was born. And it was Amsterdam. So we saw Amsterdam and we go in and I'm sort of talking to Matt in the bathroom. And as we leave the bathroom, I open the door and it's Bruce Valanche standing there, which is maybe the most random celebrity to possibly see when you're coming out of a pisser.
Was this in West Hollywood? I swear, I see that guy walking around West Hollywood.
It was at the Grove.
Kind of often. Yeah, sounds right. Yeah.
He's on like a video game NPC circuit.
Yes, exactly.
He wasn't even there to watch the movie. He walks in and out of that bathroom.
Yeah.
On like an 8-hour.
And like Matt didn't register it right away somehow. And I'm like, I look over at him and he's like, what? I'm like, was that fucking Bruce Valanche? And he had that split second of like, oh shit, that was Bruce Valanche. And I don't know who you mistake Bruce Valanche for besides himself. So anyway, the homicide cops are doing, checking the footsteps. And meanwhile, Freeman comes in and sort of big dicks everyone. Did you have a clip of that by any chance?
I did not get a clip of that. Yeah, he's great in that scene though.
Yeah, he basically tells Carver and Sidner and Herc to go get to work, and they're like, "Fuck you," and he's like, "Fuck me." No, the wire is actually what's gonna catch this guy, and so while the cops
think for one moment, for once in your life, about like how a crime gets solved.
Yeah,
just like
what did Herc and Carve think?
What was their plan? Their plan probably is to go knock heads. Right?
Yeah,
at this point in the series, that is all that they know.
No, they gotta go show the bad guys who they are.
Yeah,
yeah. So Freeman, he and his butt boy Presbyluski, they do some call tracing and follow some strings and some thumbtacks, and they realize that they've accidentally tickled the wire with this whole killing, and so they trace this sort of pattern of phone calls back to the payphone that Wee Bay and Lil Man. Lil Man's got the opposite nickname because he's a big fat guy. But that Wee Bay and Lil Man have paged Stringer from to let him know that the deed was done. And, you know, fat guy being a fat guy, wouldn't you know it, he was doing what all Americans love to do, which was drinking himself a nice soda and littering, which is the other thing that Americans like to do. He just tosses that can right there on the ground. And wouldn't you know it, fucking Lester pimp-ass Freeman comes in and finds a can and pulls a fingerprint from it.
And maybe takes a sip of it because he tells them it was still fizzy when he got it.
Yeah, it would have been great if he stuck a pinky in it and then just like wiped it on his gum.
On his gum.
Yeah, it's the real stuff. It's the real thing.
Yeah,
so, and then there's this great scene where, I mean, it's kind of a corny scene, but it's like, it's Hollywood in the way that I really enjoy, where Freeman lays his nuts on the table. I mean, it helps that Freeman's like my favorite character, but this guy,
you got a clip? You want me to play that clip?
Yeah, please play that clip.
I dusted the phone too, but it was smudged. So we got a Barksdale pro in the Northwest ringing up the boss minutes after the deed. So much for the amateur hour theory.
Good pull. You are
Freeman, Lester Freeman.
Will you work?
Pawn shop unit.
That's right.
Yeah.
You've solved the Riemann hypothesis. What department are you in? Philosophy? Mathematics? Custodial.
Yeah. It's funny. That is like, that is the second thing that reminds me of Good Will Hunting in this episode. Because there's very much like a Robin Williams, it's not your fault moment between Rawls
what if
and
that's this, what if David Simon wrote the wrote Good Will Hunting?
Yeah. Good Will
be a fucking day when I'm gonna step out of that goddamn door.
Yeah, it's Herc and Carve.
I'm not going to see your pasty white ass standing out there.
Yeah, so the cops, they're finding some shit out. We find out that Burrell is doesn't know that Kima's a lesbian, which is a fun moment. And
another, yeah, this is the Lester Freeman pawn shop unit was a place where I laughed. Burrell's reaction when he says, her sister's here.
I got
her daughter's here.
We got a clip of that.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
We'll sit over there with Kima's girl and maybe somebody from the department or the city maybe might want to say something.
Wait a minute. Who's here from the family? A daughter, you say?
A daughter?
Officer Griggs has a girl?
A roommate. The family's in Richmond, driving the first thing today. The roommate's already here.
Yeah,
is so it's the commissioner.
It's a roommate. Yeah, he tells the commissioner, and we find out the commissioner apparently doesn't fuck with lesbians. So
he
lets Burrell do it all.
Yeah, he makes a good face there too. He's kind of like, I got it. Never mind, I got it.
Yeah, so they're following up the wires. They're figuring out who's involved. Obviously, it's Savino, Weebe, and Lil Man. And so they know Savino's involved because he was the one who dropped off the money. So that leads McNulty to go. And McNulty kind of just goes rogue this episode, like even more so than other episodes. McNulty is very much like an immature asshole in this episode.
Yeah, there's the scene where he's another scene that I thought was so funny was he's just openly drinking a pint of Jameson in front of Daniels, and Daniels tells him to put it away, and he just like a sullen teenager takes another drink, like fuck you dad, I'll do what I want.
He's very much fuck you dad. He goes from there and he goes over, he ropes in his fuck buddy Rhonda Perlman, and he takes her over to the Jew lawyer's office. There's really no other way to describe him. Who's sitting there just having himself some pistachios, and basically threatens him. That says, like, you know, if you don't produce Savino, we're gonna audit your ass and find out about all these suitcases full of money and blah blah blah. And just he really throws his weight around in there. And afterwards, he and Rhonda have a scene on the street, which is another one of my favorite scenes in this episode, which I also pulled a clip of, if you want to play that one.
Play that now.
Fuck you, Jimmy. Don't tell me that was coming.
Bring him in.
He will if he can. That's not the point.
Well, what's the point?
The point is that Maury Levy is a past officer of the Monumental Bar Association. And unless I want to spend my whole life as a fucking ASA, I can't spend my afternoons pissing on people who matter.
Another career in the balance.
Fuck you.
No, fuck you. If only half you motherfuckers in the state's attorney's office didn't want to be judges, didn't want to be partners in some downtown law firm, if half of you had the fucking balls to follow through, you know what would happen? A guy like that would be indicted, tried, and convicted. And the rest of them were back up enough so we could push a clean case or two through your courthouse. But no, everybody stays friends. Everybody gets paid, and everybody's got a fucking future.
You'll just use anyone, won't you?
Got his ass.
Damn, dude.
I remember thinking, watching this episode, that speech was, I mean, that is a place where... That's a place where some of the propaganda of the show lives, is in the kind of righteous anger that is like that cops would push clean. Like, now of course Jimmy McNulty, very complicated here, and we're not meant to think that he could figure it all out if he were in charge. But I do think that it's meant to resonate with us that, like, you know, there's all this corruption outside of the kind of boots on the ground detectives in the police force that are keeping them from putting clean cases through. And that's what they would do unhampered.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's doing the same thing as the Rawls McNulty scene, which is like, it's doing the thing that The Wire does, is it gives us something that we're familiar with and we already like, which is like a cop raging against these sleazebag defense lawyers, and you think that's what it's going to be. And then it sort of gives you that twist where like the scene you like McNulty gets this whole I'm winning the Emmy worthy monologue here, but then the scene ends with Rhonda totally just body punching him and being like, yeah, okay, but you're still a fucking asshole. Like,
yeah, and this is all personal for you.
This is all personal.
You don't like that's you're using me for your own deal with your own shit.
Yeah, you're haranguing a woman whose doorstep you show up on late at night for sex frequently.
Yeah, I am constantly doing favors for you, including your custody case that I wildly inappropriate for you to ask me to do that. And now you're asking me to do this. And in the middle of all that, like, righteous anger, he's not only threatening to like audit this sort of shady lawyer, but he's threatening to like destroy Savino's mother's life in the process. Like, he's like, I'm going to go fucking knock down her door until she doesn't have a house. And it's like, she didn't do anything, man. She just gave birth to this guy who was there. Like, you need to chill out.
That's right.
Hey, Vince.
Hey, Matt.
As you know, Vince, I love old internet memes. Remember the early internet's obsession with Chuck Norris jokes?
I do remember that.
Here's one. When Chuck Norris went to college, he told his father, now you're the man of the house.
Why do you bring this up?
Well, I was thinking about those old memes, and I started thinking, I wonder what Chuck Norris is doing right now. What has he been up to?
You know, I actually know the answer to that, Matt. Yeah, I recently saw a health video he made, and I was surprised. He's in his 80s. And he still seems to have energy and health.
You know, I saw the very same video, Vince, and in it he says he's even stronger, has more stamina, and plenty of energy left over for his grandkids since making one simple health change that helps his digestion and nutrition.
That's almost too powerful to contemplate, but yes. It's true. He says he still feels like he's in his 50s. His wife made the same change, and she's never felt better. She says she feels 10 years younger and has energy all day.
I am way younger than them, and I have energy for about 2 hours a day. And the problem is, you know, that many of us do not include fruits and vegetables and other herbs that increase health and energy in our own diets. Chuck Norris made a special video that explains how he incorporated these things with one simple product.
I love special videos, and you can watch it too by going to mymorningkick.com/podyourself, and it may change your approach to your own health.
Once again, that's mymorningkick.com/podyourself, mymorningkick.com/podyourself. Go there now and watch this very special Chuck Norris video.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99 cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Yeah, so that's what's going on in the cop's neck of the woods. Meanwhile, the Barksdale crew is also sort of reeling from all the same events because they didn't know that they shot a cop initially either. And Weebe finds out in the famous meme scene. Mm-hmm.
It's the moment of the show for me.
Yeah.
It's kind of funny because it's like in the meme, you think that like Weebe finds out that he shot a cop.
Something cool.
And he does. Yeah. And it looks like the way the gif that they made out of it, it looks like they're doing a Michael Bay like rotating camera thing, but it's really only like a half turn and then it moves on. But like in gif form, it's like this whole panorama.
Well, it's a great, it's a great example of just like the repurposing of an image like out of context, because when you just use the image of him, it's him, you know, stroking his chin. Mm-hmm. And for anyone who's trying to conjure this in your mind, he's stroking his chin and he's like looking like he's amazed, you know, or shocked. And of course he's shocked because he's just found out that a cop was killed. But when but the image just as powerfully works if it's like something very cool revealed. So you're looking at something really exciting.
Well, it's also, I feel like, in the way the meme is used, it's like when someone's mind is blown by something.
Yeah, exactly.
But in this actual scene, it's like his mind's not really blown. He's kind of just like,
oh, that's bad.
He's kind of just like, oh, snap. Yeah. Like,
oh, snap. Yeah.
And it's weird. It's funny. Like, I think the thing that, another thing that makes The Wire like a really good show is that, like, throughout the season, they've sort of set up Weebay as the irredeemable criminal who you know, literally like rapes and murders a woman in like two episodes ago, and gets in a gunfight with Omar and almost kills Kima and shoots. But then this episode is kind of like about how Weebay is kind of fun to hang out with, like,
yeah.
Like, he's,
yeah, I mean, I think that
he's really casual about everything, and yeah. You're kind of like, yeah.
And that's also what makes him a great, like, that levity or softness to the character is mm-hmm. what rounds him out as, like, if he's supposed to sort of be an example of someone at the, like, the most amoral end of the criminal spectrum, you know, it's different than like when Marlo appears later, you know, where it's kind of like, is anything pleasurable to Marlo? Mm-hmm. You know, like, yeah. It kind of makes the argument that, like, no, not really. You know, like, Marlo is not a hedonist, but, like, Weebay is, I guess.
Well, Marlo's a boss, so Marlo has anxieties and concerns, and Weebay is super clear on the fact that he's a soldier, and he'll always be a soldier, and all he needs to be is a soldier. So he has no anxieties because he just does what people tell him, and he doesn't really give two shits about the consequences. So it's like he's freed from any of the guilt. I mean, I guess he just naturally doesn't have the guilt, but he's freed from any of the anxieties about worrying about cause and effect. He kind of just gets to swim through the water like a fish.
Yeah,
which
appropriate.
You know, yeah, but like this whole, he does, like, Hassan Johnson does some really good acting throughout this episode.
He really does.
I thought
so good.
Also, he seems like the guy. I've never seen someone who in my mind seems like they should be part of the Wu-Tang, but isn't. I don't know why. Like, he just has that same like affect as all of the Wu-Tang guys. But mm-hmm. He finds out that he shot a cop. He isn't that concerned about it. Stringer Bell tells him
he's
that,
so cool in this episode, that I'm glad that you reminded me that he did murder and rape that woman, because I was about to be like, he's the coolest guy on the show. I love this guy. He's my favorite character.
Oh, yeah, well, and I hadn't been watching, so I had forgotten that.
Of all the people in the Barksdale crew, he seems like one of the most chill to hang out with, as long as you're not, like, you know, a woman that he's trying to have sex with or someone that he's trying to kill.
Yeah.
But everyone else, he's just kind of a casual, like, keeping it light kind of guy.
Even after he finds out he killed the cop, or, you know, he maybe killed a cop, like, he, you know, he takes a second to be like, uh-oh. And then he's like, well, you know, I can go to Philly, I can go to this. Yeah. But, like, he's very, like, pragmatically, like, all right, well, what do we do now?
Oh, dang,
like, he would be a great coworker, too.
But
his real menace is presented through, I mean, I know you're getting to it, but it's like, it's through Dee's perspective into him that we understand that, like, this is a guy who could kill it. Like, this is a guy
he's
kill at any moment.
He's amoral.
It's what's asked of him.
He's not like Marlo or someone like that, where you expect some people that do bad things to be sadistic about it. Like, I don't know that he's necessarily like getting joy from doing bad things.
No.
It's just like, it's not a thing to him. It's just like swatting a fly. Like, oh, okay, this is my task. Yeah. And
I gotta take D on a trip.
Yeah.
You know? Yeah.
Okay. Whatever.
Like, I gotta go kill him.
I mean,
you know,
and even
it's believable,
even finding out that he has to go to a city where he doesn't know anyone. Like, most of us would be sort of like, oh shit, I gotta leave all my family and all my friends and just like go hang out in a city where I don't know anyone so the cops don't catch me. But Weebay is just kind of like, oh, Philly or DC, all right, sounds good, whatever. He didn't give a shit.
I wonder if that's, I mean, that's interesting that you bring that up, because of how maybe it functions as a counterpoint with the Wallace stuff, you know, that like,
yeah,
like, because Wallace is at the other end of the spectrum of people who don't belong in the game,
right?
You know, mm-hmm. similar to D, you know, but so it's like, and Wallace can't, now he's in the country, of course, which is which is worse, but it's at the same time, it's like, he can't, you know, he hasn't stepped foot outside.
Yeah, backing up a little bit, like, Poot basically, I didn't remember this on my first two watches, but I forgot that Poot basically gets Wallace killed in this episode, like, spoiler alert, whatever.
Yeah.
But, like, I mean, No one knows where Wallace
is, when the seeds of that are sown.
Yeah, well, no one knows where Wallace is at this point. But then Poot comes up to D'Angelo in the pit, and he's like, "Oh yeah, Wallace is on the phone." And everybody's like, "Oh shit, where's he at?" He's like, "Oh, he's down at the shore at his grandmother's house." And
the original Where's Wallace?
Yeah, that's where we find out where Wallace actually is.
Sad series of visual children's books, you know. Yeah.
But I think, you know, like Wallace is not cut out for the game, as opposed to Weebay, who's just like a creature of the game. Like he,
exactly.
Yeah. But
molded by it.
Yeah. Born in it.
Born. Yeah. So we find out that Wallace is still on the coach. Everybody
when
thinks
the air's all sticky.
Yeah. Everybody thinks he's surfing, which I don't know if that's a thing on the coast of Maryland. I have not been. Is it not? It seems like it's not, but
it seems like it. I don't know. It does, yeah. I know one guy who grew up in Maryland and he can surf, but I don't know if he learned here or there. So it seems possible, but Wallace is also very specific that he's like, no, we're on the bay side. Like we're nowhere near the water.
Yeah. Yeah.
But yeah, it is funny that Bodie's like probably surfing or some shit. Like,
yeah. So most of the people, like the peripheral people, Weebay is not concerned. Savino and Lil Man is about to get whacked. We don't know what he's thinking, but
no. How much is Lil Man in the show before this episode? I don't remember seeing
hardly
at
all. Like, we see him.
How much is he in this episode?
We see glimpses of him.
Only
that's
a
all
little
we ever
bit.
Get.
Yeah. Like, we just see him litter.
He gets
all.
Talked about a lot more than he gets seen.
Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the main people concerned are D, because he doesn't know what kind of shit's going to roll downhill. And obviously Stringer and Avon. Like Avon's kind of freaking out. I don't know. Did we pull that clip of Avon yelling at Stringer?
Stringer fucked up. I think that's probably the one. I'll play that now. Let's play that one. This happens at Orlando's.
About Savino. Well, Savino, he got to eat the charge. But he knew that. So if he keep his story tight, he's going to be all right.
Yeah, we knew Orlando was a snitching motherfucker, man. Fuck him. But this cash got us caught up.
I know, man. That's my fault, man. Bay and Savino came to me with the idea that, yo, if they take Orlando, they can take the cash, too. I was like, all right, y'all get your payday.
Yo, how the fuck is Orlando gonna front this type of cash? What it say?
I know, man. I know. I fucked up. I know.
All right, take this trash outside, fucking burn it. Tell Weebay clean up the mess before he jet.
Yeah, which is another... This is a great moment in this episode. I feel like this was the moment that we find out that Stringer Bell is a lot like most bosses in the sense that he's much better at projecting an air of authority than he is at actually like doing any of the tasks that he's supposed to be doing or like understanding... Like, he doesn't have, he's like Rawls a little bit. Like, Rawls doesn't really know how any of the drug game works, but his entire thing is when shit goes down, he can go out there and start yelling at people and sort of, you know, he can be the guy at the podium. And that's what Stringer has been. And we've kind of been led to believe that he's like the competent one because he goes to junior college and takes economics
and then
classes.
Things at the copy center. Yeah.
Yeah. But in this scene, it's like, oh no, he's really just kind of dumb like the rest of them.
Yeah. I think that's funny you would compare him to Rawls, because I think the difference between him and Rawls is I don't think Rawls would ever say, I fucked up. You know?
Yeah.
He would say, if this were. If they switch places, Rawls in that scene would be like, you know, a cop got shot, shit went bad, there's nothing to learn here, but I guess I'll burn this money.
That's the only lesson here. It's like, motherfucker, there's so many lessons here.
Yeah.
but I mean, that's partly because Stringer's talking to someone who is kind of like his boss, like someone who has power over him. So he's sort of forced to be like, oh, yeah, my bad. Whereas Rawls is almost never talking to someone who is has authority over him.
Well, and the political, like, the sort of political element is missing in the sense that, like, Stringer doesn't have an aspiration at this moment to, like, to usurp Avon or surpass him. And there's a sort of, like, there's also a brotherly trust there where... He can admit that it's his, like,
yeah.
He's one of, like, there aren't many people who could admit that it was their fault to Avon and like, you know,
and expect
and
not
see
to
the next
killed.
Morning. Yeah. Right? Yeah. And that's because of that brotherly bond there.
Yeah.
But Avon demonstrates real, like, just immediate, like, his street smarts, his, like, his nose for this business, like, for, the, like, the real ins and outs of this business is just, like, painted with such a fine point, drawn with such a fine point right here where, like, there's not even half a beat allowed to elapse between Stringer's explanation and Avon's, like, eruption of, like, how does that make sense?
Yeah. Like, yeah, we all know Orlando.
You idiot, dude. Yeah. Like, Orlando doesn't have money.
Yeah, yeah, doing the obvious takeaway from all this. Yeah, so then, you know, staying with the Barksdale crew, then we got D'Angelo. He just sort of gets called. They don't really tell D anything. That's kind of his function. He just gets called in to meet with Stringer and Weebe, and he has no idea why, so he naturally is freaked out by it. And Weebe just, like, takes him in the car, and they have this whole long interaction where D's wondering if he's going to get whacked. And it turns out he's just there to drive the car back and take care of Weebay's fish. And one of my favorite scenes in The
Amazing
Wire.
Scene.
And I don't know, there is some weird truism to the idea that people who make their living from drugs always have a ton of pets and exotic animals.
Exotic animals and stuff like that. Yeah.
Is held true in my life. I don't know.
Yeah.
Like every drug dealer I knew in college always had like a snake or a lizard.
A
fucking bird.
One time, you know, I have no idea whether they were involved in drugs, but, you know, based on this truism, one could imagine, you know, one time I saw a guy riding a bike the wrong way down a Tremont Street in Boston, which is a fast moving street. Like, it's like a four-lane street, you know, three-lane street without any bike lane. You know, he's riding the wrong way down traffic with this giant iguana just like perched on his shoulder, dude.
I don't know if that guy was a kingpin, but
an indelible image in my mind.
Yeah, I think I pulled
bought the car first, you know.
Right, you know, you need a terrarium for that thing. You just gotta get like a glass
mobile terrarium. Yeah.
Well, like a glass box in the back of his like Vespa or something.
That'd dude, an El Camino with glass put over the
oh yeah with the fucking iguana the back in it. Iguana
a terrarium in the back.
Dirt
yeah.
and fronds and turtles crawling around in it, dude.
Oh, man. You would get so many chicks with that thing.
I mean, that would be incredible.
If you had El Camino with, like, a terrarium like duplex in the back with, like, 20 lizards in it. Oh, my God.
A desert habitat. Yeah. It's got, you cut a hole in the glass for like a really tall cactus to stick over the
oh yeah, multiple lizards could, you know, climb on the same cactus. Yeah,
like put a flag on the flag on that cactus, you know.
I think you need to get into the drug business.
I have a sense for where I'd spend the money, that's for sure.
Yeah, you've got the aesthetics down, that's for sure.
Yeah.
So do you have that clip of Weebay talking
yeah,
about his
I
fish
do. I'll play
we gotta
that
play
now.
That
check it out, D. I need you to feed them while I'm gone. You're gonna give them different food for each tank, too, all right? But don't worry, I'm gonna show you what to do. Come here. These are my tetras. Got Kimmy, Alex Aubrey, and Jezebel in here somewhere. I don't know, she thinks she's cute. You take two pinches of whatever food I got next to each tank. They set for the day. See? They ain't no problems. Just beautiful as hell, D. Go upstairs and pack some shit.
Amazing. He's so...
the idea that he's interpreting... interpreting exactly. D's nervousness as like, nah, dude, it's easy to take
don't
care of
worry.
Fish.
No worries. No worries. I'm going to show you what to do. No worries.
Yeah, he's so funny. In that whole scene, he's really great. D'Angelo's great. But yeah, Weebe especially, he's like, he's this combination of oblivious and menacing, like just at rest. He's so scary. And then he... the little smile he gives him after it's like right after that, he's like, we shot a narco, D. And he kind of is like, and then he like walks away. Yeah. It's so funny. So funny. And it's,
we're such rascals.
Yeah.
Which is great because it's like, you know, to him, it's like D, you know, spoilers again, but you know, like things will shake out differently, but like D's not touchable. Like D's not a guy who Weebay is gonna take for a, like in Weebay's mind, D is not a guy who Weebay is gonna take for a drive and kill.
Mm-hmm. You know, yes.
He's, what is he? He's Avon's nephew.
Nephew.
He's like, geez, and he also gonna go get murdered.
And he had nothing to do with what happened. Like you were saying, like he's in the same way that Wallace is not like built for this. Like D'Angelo. The like his fear is very like relatable, because if I'm in a car with Weebay and he's that casual, I am also worried. But if you are like sharp, like in the same way that Avon is, you understand that like I had nothing to do with this. Yeah. For them to kill me now would be silly.
But I think part of it is that he's too smart, because like if that was Weebay, like Weebay is so dumb and fatalistic that he doesn't really give a shit. Like he'd get into that car and just assume things are gonna be all right, and that's what makes him good at the job. Whereas like D, he realizes that like no matter how little you had to do with something, all it takes is someone's perception that you did, or someone who actually did it like framing you up somehow. So he doesn't really like, he knows that he doesn't have control over what the bosses think at some level.
Yeah.
Like you can be doing a good job, but then you get a new exec in and they're like, yeah, fuck this guy. We don't know. I didn't hire this guy, whatever. He knows what the razor's edge that he lives on. That was sort of that whole storyline. And then like the last storyline, which is sort of the most tragic one. And another reason that like The Wire is The Wire, not just another procedural, because I mean this episode is super, it's a super like procedural cop show episode where they're tracking a cop killer, everyone's coming together, everyone's, you know, sad about a fucking tragedy, but then the other element of it is that, you know, you have Bubbles, who in last episode he is trying hard to stay clean and having a hard time, and Kima's supposed to help him out. And like the day that she's supposed to pick him up and do something for him, which I forget what the favor was. Do you remember what the favor was?
I mean, he asked for like a place to stay or something. Mm-hmm. And it seemed like she was going to try to figure out somewhere where he could stay.
Yeah. She was like, I got you. And he's like, okay, cool. And then next thing you know, he's paging her and he's getting picked up by the cops. And they're taking him back to the station and beating the shit out of him. And that's a good scene. I forget that guy's name, but he's like, yeah, he raised up on me.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. That huge Holly, I think, Detective Holly.
Yeah.
Who kind of looks like he could be Blake Griffin's cousin or something.
Yeah. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. So then, yeah, he's in there and then he gets his ass kicked and he tries to get someone to, he doesn't say outright that he's a CI, which is why Bubbles is like the smart, wise one in the in the drug game, because he has like a sense for self-preservation, knowing that he doesn't want more, like there's like the fewer people that know he's an informant, the better it is for him. So so far only Kima and McNulty know, so he has to talk to McNulty, and McNulty being McNulty, he's completely missing all the signals that Bubbles is trying to tell him that he's clean now.
Yeah, and he's using him.
Yeah,
so he doesn't, you know, he doesn't know anything. He's just using him.
He's a very transactional person, so he doesn't really think about Bubbles's whole deal. He also, there's at one point where he asks about Bubbles. He's like, "Oh, short guy mumbles a lot," and neither of those things like ever occurred to me about Bubbles. It's always
never thought of him as short.
Me neither.
I almost thought it was going to be when he's like in that half quarter second moment, I was like, short guy, like, oh, is he thinking of someone else?
Yeah. Like, is he thinking of a Poot or something? Like, Poot's the only. Yeah. So, yeah. So then, but it's just like this whole sequence of events is just heartbreaking, because
it's brutal.
By this point, you've come to really like enjoy Bubbles and be sort of rooting for his sobriety, even if you know on some level it's not going to last.
And, yeah, and like knowing, especially having seen the whole series, just like knowing how tragic everything is for Bubbles, it's like, ugh, just like heartbreaking the whole, every time he's on screen.
Yeah. And yeah, and this whole thing was just him getting fucked over completely out of his control in any way. And then McNulty's like, yeah, here's $20. Why don't you go buy yourself some drugs?
Aside from just the like the user aspect of like McNulty using people and using him, there's also like a little, it's not right in the scene as text, but it's in the episode that like McNulty's an alcoholic with no desire to change, no readiness to change, no right. willingness to change.
Yeah.
And so it's also like completely outside of his schema of like what a person like might want that like, you know, oh, like someone's trying to get clean, you know, like he's,
yeah. The idea of it is
he's drunk at work, you know, defensively, obstinately drunk at work.
Yeah. He's like, our friend just got shot. Why don't you do some drugs or something? That's what I'm doing.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So yeah, that kind of wraps up. And then, to wrap things up on the cop side, their response to all this, is that they're going to go do another raid. which is
dope
great
on the table.
Yeah, I think we have that's the quote, that's the pull quote in the title cards of this episode is dope on the damn table. I think we have I think I pulled the clip of that.
With ties to the Barksdale organization?
Yes, sir.
What else?
Well, the case is progressing. We're starting to glean some possible shooters from the wiretap.
You know, I asked for the control buy. I put one of our people in harm's way. So right now, I want to make sure that we are doing everything.
We are, sir. We're on it.
Good. The commissioner wants raid citywide. Every door we can take, any addresses we can write on, anything connected to a narcotics case. CID, tactical, the DEUs. And tomorrow, on the 6 o'clock news, we put a lot of fucking dope on the table. A lot of it.
Dope on the table.
We need to let them know who we are. We can't for 1 minute let them think that this will stand. The commissioner wants to send a message, Lieutenant.
Yeah. So, I mean, I think this is them being like, look, we fucked up. I know I put some people in danger by pursuing this dumb strategy. So what we got to do now is double down on that and keep doing it some more.
Yeah, I have an ass to cover, so put some dope on the table.
I also think... go ahead.
Right after that moment, doesn't, like, one of those... Like, right after what is Burrell? What's his position?
Deputy
right
ops.
After leaves.
Yeah.
Yeah, right after Burrell leaves, like, isn't one of those random kind of white guy cops, doesn't he, like, just parrot his talking point?
Yeah, he's he says we got to send a message.
We're showing him who we are.
Showing him who we are. Yeah.
And it's like, it's one of those moments where you're kind of like, there's not many weak characters. Like, there are spineless, cowardly characters in this show, but they're, like, kind of just, like, weak.
Yeah, just a garden like variety guys. Dumbass.
Not a lot of them. Yeah, we're showing him who we are.
It's the guy that, like, your dog pees on the rug and you, like, rub the dog's face in it, because it's like you're doing it, you think like that's what you've been told is the way to like correct that behavior, and it makes you feel good because you're like punishing someone for doing bad, but it doesn't actually change the thing. And I kind of think that whole sequence comes a little bit out of the run-up to the Iraq war, because like I feel like a lot of that language, like, oh, we're showing them who we are, we got to send a message, we got to go in there and like wreck shop, like even before we actually invaded, I think there was like a fair amount of people who were like, this seems like a really stupid idea. It seems like the thing that we've been doing. And it's like that same impulse where you strike back because it makes you feel good regardless of how little sense it actually makes in changing.
We're gonna put WMDs on the table.
Yeah, exactly. That's what
I mean. When do we think that this was? It's interesting because I wonder when this was written. You know, like this episode.
It's hard to
know. It aired in August, and like, it's. But what we can be probably pretty sure of is that September 11th, which happened almost a year before this aired, probably factored in whether or not at the draft, initial draft stage, you know, like at some point in the production of this episode, it absolutely was what was in the air.
Oh, yeah. And just the idea of like, oh, we got to send a message. We got to show people who we are.
This is their 9/11.
Yeah. We got to prove that you can't mess with us.
They should have had a set. They should have been two cops in the car, you know?
Yeah.
To just really hammer the metaphor home.
Yeah. Second bullet has hit, or second plane has hit the cop.
Yeah. Second. Yeah, exactly.
Is that, I think that's the, I think we got everything in the episode. Did we cover
there's the conversation about the raids. Yes. And then that scene is confusing to me because who is yelling at Daniels? Cause it's not Burrell.
It's just someone else that we don't know.
It was a weird decision. It was kind of a weird decision. Cause I was looking, cause it happens in the background of the scene.
Yeah. It almost seemed like he was unavailable and they got somebody who looked like him.
I mean, I think, almost absolutely
yeah,
with some production decision like that.
I don't know, but here's what I like about that sequence is that I feel like at most jobs I've had, the way that you find out that something is wrong is you hear people yelling in another room. Like most of the time,
that's true.
Most of the time you don't hear about like shit directly. It's sort of like you sort of hear shouting or you hear commotion. You hear something bad from somewhere else. If you're not the top guy, they're usually not like sharing that information for you. It's just sort of something that you pick up on from being near it.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So I really
just
like
that they didn't send, it's not physically, the deliverer of the bad news is sort of a messenger that you can't really make out who they are.
Yeah. Like, are they above Daniels or are they?
Exactly. Yeah. It was a little, but that could also be a choice for exactly for a similar reason that kind of like, you know, the, Brass loves to deliver good news, and then when they decide to go in a different direction or whatever,
they send someone else to deliver.
We've sent a guy to tell you that we're kind of everything that was flying around in the air before is I changed my mind about or whatever.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Everything we pretended to be, that was actually bullshit. Sorry about that.
And then there's the raids. They get their dope on the table.
That whole sequence is sort of, this is Daniel's face turn. Cause like the whole season, he's sort of been writing that line. Like we know he has a past that is a little bit murky. We don't entirely know like what he supposedly did, but, he's in this role of, he's like the gatekeeper between McNulty and Freeman and people who actually want to do this work, but he's also this very like careerist person, so he can either have the people under him's back, or he can sell them out to the bosses in order to
and have a future.
This episode sort of makes clear that he's having a face turn and conveys it. I mean, I guess there's the action of him telling them that he's not going to raid any place that matters to jeopardize the wire, but a lot of it is just like looks that he gives throughout this episode.
Yeah
I mean, he's a heavy hitter. He's really great.
Yeah. And then am I wrong, or did they do raid the stash house, right? The mm-hmm. that they don't want to, they have to, right? That's where Herc and Carve get the money.
That's what I gathered because that's what that conversation is about.
Yeah.
Right? They know about the main stash house. They know we're holding it back. Mm. And then they put so much dope and so many guns and so much money on the table. And cause they were just going to raid a tower, and that was clearly a house. So I think they had push came to shove. Mm-hmm. They had to do what the bosses wanted.
Yeah. And that's where we see Herc and Carve take the money. And to your point, like, they're still so much more likable than Rawls or the commissioner. Like, I would much rather see a cop take some money from a drug bust than deny a police person's partner the moment of consolation icky, gay. You know?
I mean, there's like so many levels of things that you could call propaganda, but I think for the general public, like the idea Like if a cop does a drug raid and they seize like $50,000 and two cops take like a $5,000 bundle for themselves, I think most people are like, yeah, I don't really care. But then like you find out, then you get to like, you fast forward, what, 20 years since the show, and we get We Own the City, and we realize like the cop gang setting up that bust, like they did it solely as a money making enterprise.
Exactly. Yeah. Yeah, and I mean it's just contextual too, is like sitting it back in 2002 into the place of like, you know, showing them doing that with no real justification is itself critical of the police.
Yeah, right? For sure.
Like,
I mean, this is
what you would typically see on television, or yeah, the cop beating up Bubbles and then just straight up lying about why he did it.
Yeah, I mean, this showed them doing bad things, but largely in ways that we probably would have considered sort of acceptable.
Yeah.
Even then, even though we were not like used to seeing that on TV for sure.
Yeah.
So yeah, I think that about does it for me on this episode. Favorite, least favorite, Brent.
My favorite scene is definitely D'Angelo and Weebe and the fish. We've covered that pretty extensively. My least favorite scene, we didn't talk about it at all, and I'm fine with it because I didn't care about it at all, but where McNulty goes to the fundraiser that the judge is at because he's back on the ticket. And I just had no idea what purpose that served. Like, was the judge the rat? Is he the one talking to Raul? Like, it was just like, who is this for? I don't fully understand what's happening. I don't really care. I've never in this whole season, I understand the judge is like who kicked it off and he serves an important function. I don't give a shit what's going on with the judge.
Yeah.
And so like, yeah. And even McNulty, like, I don't know. It seemed like a good opportunity for McNulty to like make a scene and and like around people he shouldn't make a scene around. And even that doesn't happen. So it's just like, who is this for?
Right. I mean, I think it's just a way to communicate like, oh, this guy that McNulty could call in favors from immediately like folded under any promise of like, you know, any threat to his career.
Oh, so yeah, that was, I guess maybe that was supposed to be our indication that they were going to have to raid the stash house, whether they wanted to or not.
Okay. I think so. Yeah.
Yeah.
Ben, favorite, least favorite.
Probably, I mean, you know, the fish house is a pretty key scene. I'll just flag one thing about it that we didn't talk about, which is just that like the level of technical direction, it's great how they track D into the house and we're on his face as he grows. We're in front of him on his face as he's walking into the house, as he grows more and more anxious that he's walking to his doom. And as he walks into the house, it's dark, and so then we don't see his face anymore. And then Weebe comes in behind him and turns on the lights, and we get on his face that he's crying. And that's just like really, it's really well done how he moves from just on one side of the edge to completely over the edge while he's in the dark.
Yeah,
really good. Least favorite? I don't know. I wasn't prepared. I wasn't prepared for this. You know? I gotta think.
Okay, I'll jump in here.
If I come up with anything, I'll say it. Otherwise, I'll take a buy on it.
I mean, I agree with Brent that the fish scene is unexpectedly funny and a scene that I didn't necessarily remember, but goddamn, is it a good scene. I also really liked the scene of Jimmy and Rhonda outside on the street. Like it's kind of a conventional, like Hollywood corny kind of scene with a big actory monologue, but just the way that she busts him and the way that he comes out, like just the way that they played that, where you know, he comes out seeming like an asshole and she doesn't have many lines, but it feels like she lands the memorable one in that somehow. Really like that scene. As far as least favorite, I have a clip of it. I think this is some of the worst acting that's ever been on this show. It's when they're doing the raids and there's this guy that we've never seen before who's shaking down Savino's mom.
Who ain't here?
Zach, he ain't here!
Zach? No, honey, we're looking for Savino.
Savino? No, he's my baby!
Yeah, well, your baby shot a cop.
10-6. That's an after-school special-ass scene right there.
Yeah.
That, and I feel like that is the standard of what you would see on a cop show in 2002.
I mean, it sounded like an iced tea delivery. Law and Order or whatever.
There's one more scene where I thought the acting was kind of bad, which is when Carver goes to tell Kima's girlfriend that she's in the hospital. It's whatever. It seems like a hard scene to act, and I don't think they quite pull it off, but it's, you know, it's short, it's not a big deal. But I was just kind of watching it like, oh, these are not the two best actors on the show, and they're being given kind of a lot to do, just the two of them, and it's weird.
Yeah, I like what they're doing. Like, I think they're trying to make the point that the worst kind of grief is the kind that's mixed with guilt, and I think that's part of why everybody is like going so over the top. But I do think that they kind of like overplay it in places, and that was probably one of those places. I don't know. But yeah, that about does it. What else do we need to say but to wrap up here, Brent?
I mean, we got to give it a grade.
Oh, that's right. Yeah.
Yeah. After you, go ahead, Vince.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, obviously, this episode, a lot of ins, a lot of outs, a lot of what have yous. Classic TV. I feel like they were partly setting the prestige TV template here by having like all this shit happen like right before the end, and then sort of take stock with the last episode. So yeah, a lot to weigh. I'm gonna put it on my balancing scales, and I think I have to give it a solid B+.
Yeah, that's fair. I think. I think I agree that it feels. Now, knowing that this is what all prestige, like this is the formula now. So like going into it kind of knowing that like, yeah, of course, we're going to have our big event. And then now we have the fallout going into the last couple episodes. But I think they execute like so much of it so well. There's probably only about 15% of this episode that I don't think is great. So I'm going to give it a B+. B+. Yeah.
Okay.
I don't like to go against the pack. You know, so I feel comfortable kind of sitting right in, I don't want to be the tall nail, you know, and so I'm going to go ahead and give this one a B+ as well, which was what I had written down for it, but I'm pleased to know that I'm sitting pretty there.
Yeah.
You know, it doesn't soar to the heights of season 3 or 4 for me, you know, but it doesn't sink to the lows of some of season 5, and so... and to me, those would all be, you know, right around here in terms of quality. It doesn't differ too much, you know, but so this one's B+.
B+. I think that's an average of about a B+. Yeah. Pretty good episode. Yeah.
Cool. All
right. And an A+ episode of Find Yourself the Wire.
Yeah. I'm going to give this one an A+ as well.
Yeah. Hell yeah. Ben, thanks so much for coming on. Do you have anything you would like to plug before we go?
Oh, thank you so much for having me. You know, what I would love to plug is my podcast, Please Save Me, with Sarah Black. Please Save Me is a recap podcast for television's number one show, Chicago Heroes. The only problem with Chicago Heroes, of course, is that it does not exist. But so what I would say is go listen to that. There's about 70 episodes of that. Sarah and I have a new podcast that's going to be coming up soon. Tentatively, that's called Crime Watchers. And so keep your... If you like Please Save Me, keep your ears peeled for the new one. And if you hate it, then you'll know a new podcast you don't need to check out.
Mm. Yeah, that's always a weight off my mind.
Check out Please Save Me and Crime Watchers on everywhere you find podcasts. Thanks a lot again, Ben, for doing the show. Vince, do we have any... I didn't see any names for you to give nicknames. Do we have any of those?
I don't know if these have been updated. Have they?
I don't know. Well, we can always edit it out if it's not, but I got some names here, so I'll read them off and then you can give them nicknames. All right. These are for our $8 patrons. I think it's still called the Pod Yourself a Shout Out tier. If you like the show and you want to make sure that Matt can feed his child, you can sign up for the Patreon. $8 a month gets you a shout out on the show. And Vince will give you a corner nickname. Yeah. So starting with our first new patron, Kevin Dwyer.
Yeah, we call him Special K.
Special K.
Yeah.
Special K. And then we have one, a special, it seems like, a baby signed up. It says you're William Roush's newborn baby.
Oh, yeah. Well, we're going to call him Squirts. Because, that's what babies do. That's what they're made of.
Yeah, perfect. Well, Squirts, thanks for signing up. This one kind of... Anyways, next up we got Byron Hooper.
Hooper. Oh, this guy hoops it up. I'm going to name him after my favorite Hooper, Draymond.
Draymond. Thanks for signing up, Draymond. And our last name, our last new patron, Peter. Sorry if I mispronounce this, but Peter Merez.
Is it Merez or is it Mayor? I'm going to call him Horse. Because,
Horse.
Yeah, he's the horse.
Yep. Perfect.
I just want to throw out there, you pop over to patreon.com, you can spend yourself a Flores. I am going to get out looking for $7.
Oh, shit. We're getting underpriced.
Yeah, that's a pretty good deal.
We're going to find out how elastic this market is. product. Yeah.
All right. Sick. Thanks for listening. And if you come at the king, you best not miss.
Boom.
Okay, so this next Balmer B story is by Norah Jones from a song that came out in 2002. I'll be real with you, I couldn't figure out which version I like better, the high octave or the low octave, so I just did both of them together. Not the best choice I've ever made, but also I'm tired, so.
I waited till I saw them come. Don't know where I put my gun. I taped it somewhere up in front. Don't know where I put that gun. I don't know where I put that gun, bitch. When I saw them shoot at me, I called in signal 13.
My daughter loves that song, but now with those lyrics.
Springtime savings are in full bloom, all in the Kroger app. Buy one, get one free on flavorful, fresh Tyson chicken during our full line sale. Then mix or match during our 99-cent sale and get Kraft mac and cheese, Campbell's soup, or Bar S Franks for 99 cents each when you buy five or more, all with your card. Shop these deals at your local Kroger today, or tap the screen now to download the Kroger app to save big today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Prices and product availability subject to change. Restrictions apply. See site for details.